You're listening to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to trash since 1977.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. We are back for another lovely week of genre, movie, podcasting, just film podcasting, just talking about movies. It's Willie and Sammy and, well, that's us. That's all you got. So, but I think it's more than enough. What do you think, Will?
And this is my first time recording a podcast. I would hardly concur with that statement.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's good. I can fix that in post, as they say.
Oh, yeah, that'll be a seamless edit.
It will be, I promise. This week, Will selected the film we're going to be talking about. So we're going to talk about Happy Together, another Wong Kar-wai joint, one of Will's favorite filmmakers. This is early cycle, well, semi-early cycle, Wong Kar-wai, also known as Chun Gwang Cha-sit. I think is how you would say it. Cha-sit, maybe.
Enough, I think.
Yeah, we'll get to it here in just a little bit. It was an interesting watch, no doubt. So we'll talk about that here in a little bit. Let's get into, well, I don't have any feedback. I don't have anything this week. So Walt may still be under the weather. I don't know what's going on. Or maybe he just didn't get around to listening yet. We miss you, Walt. Anybody else wants to, though, they can send in voicemail as well. You know, we're reachable. We do communicate. I know for a long time we didn't, but we are back into that world now. So let's get into what we've been watching then, man. What have you been up to? I watched one thing this week. I've had a very busy week. And, well, two things, counting Happy Together. So there you go. But what have you watched? I know you watched a few things that I'm interested to hear your thoughts on.
Okay. I watched a documentary on the Criterion Channel. As they've evolved, I feel like they've done a really good job curating things and sort of programming things thematically and otherwise. Retrospectives. And I'd seen a Japanese documentarian pop up I wasn't familiar with, Kazuo Hara.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw that there was a documentary on there called Goodbye CP, as in cerebral palsy. And this documentary sounded fascinating to me. I'm just going to quickly summarize it on IMDb. An intimate documentary about a group of people with cerebral palsy in Japan that confronts our preconceptions and prejudices about who they are. So this was an astounding watch. Hara walks the tightrope between clear-eyed documentarian and also respecting his subject without pandering or going for the low-hanging emotional fruit. It's a hard watch, but he never is maudlin or calculating about it. He's very matter-of-fact and respectful. This was an incredible watch for me. When we do our top 30 or whatever we do, top whatever of the year, I think this will be on there. I know it'll be on there. It was a fantastic documentary. So Hara, I'm curious to dig into his other stuff. Next up was one the wife and I were looking for something to watch. I feel like you've probably seen this because we're both fans of the filmmaker. It's on Netflix, Guy Ritchie's Wrath of Man. Have you seen this?
I haven't seen it yet. No, I know of it, but I have not watched it.
So it's got Chev Chelios himself in it. this Zom's favorite, Loaf's favorite. This is an interesting film. It feels like Ritchie. This feels more like a David Ayer or Anton Fuqua film than it does a Ritchie film. It's got some really willfully meat-headed kind of dick-swinging dialogue. Like, it's almost like Bruno Mattei, you know, what was it, Perfect Dark? I can't remember what his Aliens ripoff is, but when there's that really, like, meathead macho dialogue, like the banter between buddies.
Yeah.
It's got some of that in this, and it's all right. You know, like I said, it feels like a medium range effort from Ayer more than anything, maybe. But it's decent. It's got a good cast, you know, outside of Chev Chelios himself. Hoyt, what's his name? Hoyt something. He's in everything now. Hoyt Mick something.
Oh,
McElroy or
McElhenney or whatever. I think it's the guy that was in Creepshow too, right? Played the Indian, I believe.
No.
Yeah, I think it was like his first role.
Dude, you just blew my mind. He was also in, it's back-to-back weeks where I've done film, Hoyt Jams. He was in Nightmare Alley.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, he is in that. That's right.
I think he's probably my second favorite Hoyt in the film world. Hoyt Van Hoytema being first.
I don't know. That's a tough one. I do love both Hoyts, though.
Both Hoyts are good.
Yeah, both Hoyts are pretty solid. You can't go wrong with a good Hoyt.
This is true. This is very true. So yeah, this was solid. I mean, you could do worse. People that watch our show, I think you could do worse than this. Cheb's pretty good in it. I gotta say, Statham is De Niro to Ritchie's Scorsese, right? Like, it just hand in glove.
Yeah. It seems like they have that kind of relationship.
Yeah, no, they totally do. Next up was one that I've been curious about, but kind of a bit apprehensive. It was The Eternals.
Oh, yeah. So this is one that I was interested to hear your opinion on.
All right. So we all, you know, we've said it's well documented on this show. We're big Marvel fans. I love Chloe Zhao. I think she's a tremendous filmmaker. I felt like she was a peculiar choice to make a Marvel film. I know that, you know, I've said often on the air that, and in my personal life, that Marvel has done this incredible feat of juggling 30 films. They've all been pretty good quality-wise. You know, all in all, no complaints. But she just felt like an odd choice for this because of her intimate, kind of natural, almost Malickian style of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we watched it, and I don't know, man. This one's 3 hours long.
Yeah, it's a pretty long one.
Yep, and it opens up pretty fun, I gotta say. Like, it opens up and it's solid, but I feel like what this has working against it is a lot of familiarity. You know, Captain Rick, you're gonna have to hold. My wife's called me twice here. Give me one sec here. So I mean it lacks familiarity, right? Like, we know Captain America, we know Ultron. I mean, I read comics as a kid. I can have a comic book conversation. I mean, I can't go super in depth, but, you know, I read Image and a lot of DC and Valiant and Dark Horse and all that. So, I mean, I know a little bit about comics and I knew about the Eternals, but it just feels like the enormity of what they're trying to dot connect with the Eternals and a lack of familiarity with the characters and a left field choice for this film kind of all adds up to this decent. I don't want to say it's mediocre, but
yeah.
I don't know. You know, the cast is good. I really like Gemma Chan. She's great.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Don Lee's fun.
Yeah.
Salma Hayek feels miscast, but other than her, I think everyone's really good in the film. I don't know. I mean, I'd be curious what people who really, really know the material well, how they feel about it. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to say it's a bad film, but like I said, I think it's so enormous in scope and scale that it almost loses some intimacy. And the ironic thing is you're using a very intimate filmmaker. So if it almost feels like this is the elevator pitch. Terrence Malick and J.J. Abrams rushed Love Child.
It's not a bad comparison, I'll have to say.
So it worked.
Yeah, it's interesting. I quite enjoyed it. I think it was because it felt like a film for a change. I've been on the record saying that I don't think the Marvel movies feel much like films. I think they feel more like a gigantic TV show. And what I liked about this one is it actually felt like a movie. It kind of felt like what DC does, where they bring a filmmaker in and they kind of give them free rein. It's certainly flawed. There's no doubt about that. It's way too long. But that's most modern films anyway. I enjoyed it. I thought some of the comedy was a little out of whack, but I understood it's a long movie. They were probably trying to lighten the burden a little bit of the movie. But it does. I think when I've seen people's criticisms of it, I think probably the biggest thing that comes out of it is that lack of familiarity, because you're going, I mean, this was a pretty risky move by Marvel in a lot of ways, because they went really deep into the frying pan to pull some characters out. I was kind of stunned when they even heard they were going to make an Eternals movie, because, like, you know, only about five people I know growing up even read the Eternals.
Wasn't it a Kirby?
Yeah, it was a Kirby thing, yeah. And it was fine. It's interesting, but it's not exactly the Marvel I think people are used to. So I think, you know, it sets up, I guess, what their whole big cosmic plan is for their whole bunch of next movies. And it seems interesting because I think they're using filmmakers again, right? I think they're trying anyway. They're using Sam Raimi for Doctor Strange 2, and then I can't remember who's making the next one after that. But for me, that's exciting because, I mean, I can't take another Russo Brothers film.
See, I like them a lot more than you do. I do agree that there's a certain, oh, man, everyone tonight, let's just have a party. Cousin who I never talked to is calling me on Facebook Messenger. Anyway, not to sound like I don't care about family, I do. Like Don Toretto, family first, but
yeah. Just timing. Timing is everything. Man.
I hear you though, man. And like I said, I would never say it's a bad film. I don't know, man. I just
it suffers from the thing that I think most comic book films suffer from me, which is you know, the big bad being some gigantic CGI thing or something.
And it's too abstract. And frankly, I think the world-building CGI is great, but the creature CGI stuff is pretty subpar.
Yeah, and it's pretty, the deviants or whatever they're called, it's pretty
anonymous and uninspired.
I suppose. It just feels like every other CG creation in a lot of ways. So that part I didn't care for and stuff. But yeah, as time's gone on, I've come to appreciate it quite a bit. It's interesting. I think, honestly, I'll say this. I'll go on the record now. I would bet money that this will age better than every other Marvel film.
I would half agree with you.
Yeah.
I will agree with the half of this will age well. Because I think once you take away the burden of expectation, and people can look at this as a film and a risk that they took, and kudos to them for taking a risk, it'll serve it well over time.
Yeah. I liked that there was actually shadows. I was like, wow, this is a Marvel movie. They're actually using shadows.
And I thought that, as silly as it sounds, we actually get, and it's just very casual, there's a gay couple in this. There's a sex scene.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that was kind of odd. That came out of nowhere. But
it was like, whoa. And I unnaturally uncomfortable because the context of it being a Marvel film, right? Like,
yeah,
ooh,
yeah. Awesome. It was surprising, yeah.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, some folks have really rallied against it. But, yeah, no, I quite enjoyed it. I do think, though, it does suffer from, again, like you said, the same thing that I talked about with Batman last week, which was, I mean, at some point, Jesus, I mean, how much story do we need? So, but that's me. You know, I know that's not everybody. Some people can watch all 25 or 30 Marvel films once a year. I could probably maybe watch two of them again this year. They just don't really interest me. They don't really... There's no, for me, it is a feat to make a big budget film, but to me, and I used to say this to Todd all the time, there's no Russo Brothers signature. There's no, Yeah, I mean, if you can name a Russo Brothers signature, I'd like to hear it. Nobody can name one though. It's just a big fat commercial. So yeah. That's the problem I have with a ton of the Marvel films is they all just feel like, you know, big commercials. The Captain Marvel one especially, that one really felt like a big, and then I come to find out that the whole thing was kind of made by committee and kind of made up as they went. So not a surprise. But you know, I still think that if they use filmmakers, they could do well. And I think, you know, Taika Waititi was the best example, because I do think Thor Ragnarok is the only, for me, Marvel film that really stands out.
It's a lot of fun. It is a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it completely stands out. It's got a unique look. It's got Taika Waititi moments. It's got interesting camera angles, interesting use of sound and everything, and just much more original. But again, I'm not going to knock anybody that likes all that other stuff. That's fine. I mean, it is... They are one big, great, glorious television show. That's what I always say.
Yeah, see, and again, this is, like I said, where we're on different sides. I love them. To me, they're like Star Wars. Like yeah. I say to my kids, like the Marvel films are like our Star Wars as a family. So, yeah. But it's their own. To each their own, totally. But yeah, this is interesting. And did you ever get around to seeing Chloe Zhao as the writer?
Yeah, I've seen everything she's done.
Man, she's a good filmmaker.
Yeah. A lot of the same themes here.
Yep. Absolutely. On a much bigger sandbox.
Indeed.
Okay, so watched a film that I, on the surface, would have had very little interest in. Filmmaker pulled me in, and this would make a top 5 to 10 of the year for me. Pablo Larraín Spencer.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I saw you watch this.
This is so good. Larraín has this knack for, and he did this even with Jackie. Jackie's great, but I think this is superior to Jackie.
Yeah.
Jackie and this both focus on kind of similar things, but you know what's interesting about this one? Not to spend too much time on it. This feels very much like The Shining.
Oh yeah.
And that's why I'd almost be curious for you to see it, to see if I would be stunned if you didn't. I know you get the same vibes. It feels like Larraín riffing on The Shining in
that,
a big way.
That definitely has my interest now.
Oh, I know you'll see it because he frames his shots immaculately. I can't remember the DOP's name. She's tremendous. And I was so struck with how similar I found it that I right away was like, Spencer Shining comparison or something. And there's a few pretty good articles that kind of do shot to shot and just the themes of holiday season, mental breakdown, isolation in this big, cold residence.
Right.
The specters of the past. Because this isn't so much like a bubbly kind of soap opera. Or it's more of a kind of poetic riff on a lot of things and an interpretation, right? So
Yeah.
I really dug it, man. I think Kristen Stewart she crushes it. She's tremendous in this. Really good. And everyone's great. Like, you know, Timothy Spall. I mean, everyone's killer in it, man.
Yeah, I'll check it out. I probably will at some point.
So what else did I watch? I watched one that didn't age as well as I would have liked it to, man. Oliver Stone's Any Given Sunday.
Yeah, that's a movie of its time.
It's very of its time. So I wanted William to watch this one. I had forgotten there's a few. I'd rather him not see.
Yeah, cocaine snorted off a nipple. Yeah.
Off a nipple. But I see this is behind the scenes sometimes, right? And but nonetheless, I think there's a good movie in there, but it really feels like this is Stone and his editor at their sort of like cokiest in a way, which says something. But it's the editing and the cinematography are so jarring and distracting and fatiguing in this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too bad because you get some good performances. Pacino's good. Fox is fine. James Woods is good.
Yeah.
It's, you know.
I'd have to go back and revisit that. I don't remember enough about it. I just remember it was very of its time.
It is very of its time.
Yeah. And that was during that whole era of, it was kind of like the Oliver Stone / Tony Scott era of Oliver Stone.
This feels like Stone riffing on Scott with Oak and
And that's what Natural Born Killers felt like to me, and and then that one, and it seemed like there was one more that was like that. U-Turn, which Todd and I did.
Yes, I know you did. See, yeah. I almost don't want to go back and watch Natural Born Killers because I have a fond sort of recollection of it, and I feel like it might just, it's going to fatigue me, you know?
Yeah. I don't know if I'd ever watch Natural Born Killers again unless somebody asked me to be honest with you. I'm not saying I didn't like it. I enjoyed it for what it was, but...
Yeah, I'm with you.
I don't know if I'd ever revisit it. Don't know if it's... It's never really kind of sparked my attention for a revisit for whatever reason.
No, see, a few times I've kind of thought about it. I thought, well, no, I'll just watch True Romance or something. I don't know. Which I think will age better. But yeah, that one, I don't know. Who knows? But this was okay. Funny, William. So I chose that. And I guess William must have loved Pacino in it, because he's getting to the age where we're showing him stuff like he's seen some De Niro joints. So we showed him like A Bronx Tale. And what has he seen with Pacino? He loves the Ocean's films. Like, he just loves the Ocean films. So Pacino's in that. And so we watched Any Given Sunday. Then he was like, for his pick, he's like, yeah, I want to watch Heat. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and Heat's one that I, and I believe you, have both gone on record as saying we like but don't love as much as even probably most of our listeners and friends.
There's probably going to be a record scratch sound in some people's houses when I say this, but I do not think Heat is a masterpiece.
See, yeah, I think Thief is his masterpiece.
Yeah, I don't even think Heat's a masterpiece of any sort. I think it's a little bit like the Eternals and Batman. It's way too long and kind of boring in spots. I love it. There's scenes in it I love. Mm-hmm. But man, Pacino takes me out of that movie every time.
Ah, he's really turned up in this one.
Yeah, he's got a lot of great lines in it. But he just takes me out of the movie. I love the De Niro.
Seedy.
Yeah. I love the De Niro Val Kilmer angle. I love the De Niro and Kevin Gage, I believe the actor name is.
He's good in it. Yeah. I forgot about that angle with him and how kind of, for lack of a better word, how evil he is in it.
Yeah. I like those angles. I like Tom Sizemore in the film.
Sizemore's great in it.
Yeah, but the good guys, all of the cops, I can't stand.
They're very bland. It's like the first runaround LeBron James did with the Cleveland Cavaliers. Like, he has like a Vitaly Potapenko at best as his like running mate.
Yeah.
Whereas De Niro's got he's got everyone. He's got so many fun character actors to play with. De Niro's great. I think Pacino's great in it. And I'll tell you, going back and watching the scene with those two, mm-hmm. I mean, it is just a masterclass in kind of dick swinging cool. It is pretty cool to see. Like, it's hairy macho bullshit at its finest.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah.
Both of them are just fucking whipping their dicks out and showing off their chest hair. And
then they would go on and make Righteous Kill together.
Which I thought about when I was watching that scene, and I didn't want to tell William that they went on to make a real turn. I was trying to explain the gravity of the moment here. Like, William, people waited for the scene for 30 years.
Yeah.
This two goats. They wanted them in a film. They got them in a film. This is the scene.
Yes.
You know, so.
And then they got a movie, and the movie was old men working out movie. And then they did get them back in good form, though, with The Irishman. There's a lot of good scenes with De Niro and Pacino and The Irishman that don't get talked about enough.
No, I agree with you. Yeah. I agree with you 100%, man. 100%.
A lot of good scenes with them two together there.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Just one final one here because I'm running long. Teresa picked one that I think, I want to say, was it Kevin? I'd have to go back and give them, you know, proper shout out for this in a message. But someone had recommended we watch The Adam Project. They felt like it'd be a good family watch for us. And being Canadian, I think we have a softer spot for Ryan Reynolds than most.
Yeah.
We watched this, and I think it does what it says on the tin. I think it's sweet. It's Amblin-y. Cinema gold. What did you just say? Rick heard it. I didn't somehow.
Somebody said it was cool.
Cinema gold, she said. Oh. Yeah. What do you give it out of 10?
Family movie.
Yeah, that sums it up. It's a good, cute family movie. So it's good. Production values are good. I love Ruffalo. He's just, he's heartbeating a lot of things. Reynolds, the young Reynolds in this, who plays young Ryan Reynolds, they cast the kid perfectly. What can I say? You know, it was a good one. It was for family, for family stuff when your kids are maybe a little too old. Like, you know, you're looking for a little Chicken Soup for the Family Soul. You want a little Amblin, side of Amblin? This is a good one, I guess.
Yeah, a little side of Amblin. There you go. Yeah, I saw it was on there. I didn't. I steered clear because I had watched Free Guy.
Oh, I have not seen Free Guy.
And it was the same filmmaker and Ryan Reynolds again. And I was like, yeah, no thanks.
See, and that's the thing. I love Ryan Reynolds. I think he's a great guy.
I'm sure he is a great guy, but I don't think I like anything he's ever done.
But I think mileage really varies with him.
Yeah.
I did not have any interest in Free Guy. My wife watched it. They loved it. Good for them.
Oh, my God.
I watch, you know, Indonesian action films from the 80s, so I can't throw stones at anyone. But
Yes. I mean, yeah, I'm happy for people who enjoyed it. My son enjoyed it, but Free Guy. But, man, brutal.
I gotta tell him to get you to watch the Adam Project nearby.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing: it can't be worse than Free Guy. There's no way.
I would, sight unseen, I would agree with you.
Yeah, and I enjoyed the experience of watching Free Guy once, but it's one of those movies that after you watch it, like the more you think about it, the more you dislike it.
I've been there, and I didn't want to see it. I'm glad that was. She's like, I went and I watched it. And
I very rarely don't recommend films to people. I would not recommend anybody see Free Guy. So there you go. I always tell people to, you know, get your own decisions, make your own decisions, but
man down the gauntlet, man.
Yeah.
Wants part of it.
I haven't even seen the Adam Project. Watch that instead.
I'd rather watch, what about the Sammy Project?
The Sammy Project's a good, that'd be a good one. We can build a bigger, faster, stronger machine. All right. Okay. So that's everything.
That is everything.
Well, I'm glad you had stuff to talk about though, because I only have one film. So that kind of fills out the show a little bit there.
Nice.
I watched one thing, a film I'd read a lot of buzz about over the last year or so, After Yang. It's a weird title. It's a science fiction movie with Colin Farrell in it, so I'm still on the Colin Farrell train a little bit here, and Jodie Turner-Smith. And this is about a family that adopts a young girl from China, and... in this future world, our world, you can have these surrogate siblings, and you can buy them, depending on your income, you can buy them secondhand, kind of like buying a secondhand iPhone.
Are they human or are they like android?
They're android, humanoid. Okay. They can eat and everything, so I guess they can logically do all the other things humans can do. So this movie kind of deals with AI and feelings and stuff, so this is really, really hardcore science fiction. It's really subtly told. This is directed by Koganada. Now, Koganada did that Columbus film. I want to say it starred that, what's his name, that was in Cowboy Bebop recently. It's where he goes to Indiana, and there's a bunch of, there's this one town in Columbus, Indiana, I believe, that has all these rare kind of architectural buildings and stuff. You may have seen a trailer for it over the years. I knew this was an independent darling because, of course, it has Clifton Collins Jr. in there. So you always know that you got an independent film on your hands when Clifton shows up.
Clifton Collins is, to me, what Ryan Reynolds is to you.
Yeah. He's not in this much, but he's really good in the small part he plays. But this is a really interesting look at feelings, growth, and how technology plays a part in our lives. And it's not told in a negative way or a positive way. It's just told in the way that it's there and it's not going to go away. As a matter of fact, it's going to become more permeative. It's going to get into our lives even more, whether we like it or not. And it's very interesting because it kind of gets into the human feeling. So it's kind of like, I never saw Her, but it's kind of like that, where these people develop these relationships with this humanoid very human looking sibling. And it's a very deep film. Definitely had some tears flowing, some rough stuff to deal with in here. A lot of talk of life and love and loss and all that kind of thing. Very, very well done. Colin Farrell is absolutely amazing in this film. This has one of the best marriage performances I've ever seen in any film ever made between him and Jodie Turner-Smith. They fight, but they don't just scream at each other. They disagree, but they try to agree. They try to do what's right. It just really is a very, very well done, in my opinion, science fiction movie. I can't recommend it enough. Like, if we'd ended up doing a, I think it's this 2021 film, so I guess it wouldn't count, but if I did a top 30 first time watches again this year, this will definitely be on that list, because this is, I mean, to me, this is like a sci-fi classic. Like, this is like as good as it gets science fiction wise. And it's not big and fancy. There's no fancy special effects here. You're not going to get any of that, but it will make you think. So,
yeah, I wanted to watch this and I didn't get a chance to. Colin Farrell gets all the flowers. I agree. He is making all the right choices. I'm really excited to watch this one. And now that you have repped for it, mm-hmm. I'm more on board.
It's really sweet, too. It's a really sweet movie. And also, I know this is going to blow people's minds, but it's only 90 minutes long.
Imagine that.
It gets a lot of ideas out in 90 minutes. So it's a really good example of, in my opinion, how you make a film like this. And, yeah, I can't recommend it enough. So people check it out. So at least the only one film I watched, it was a banger, so to speak.
Nice.
So there you go. But be warned, it is a slow-paced film, and it's about human emotion and feelings and things like that. So you're not going to get explosions or Clifton Collins doing gangster talk. That's not going to happen here. So if that's what you're looking for, or if you're even going to look for Colin Farrell overacting, or even... I mean, he's real subtle in this. As subtle as I've ever seen him. I don't know if I've ever seen him this subtle, actually. He's got a great mustache in this, though. He's rocking the stash. He sells tea. It's a very interesting. At first, I'm like, oh, this kind of hippy-dippy shit's this. What am I watching? But I really come to fall in love with the family aspect of this movie. So check it out if those things sound interesting to you. We're going to take a short break. Come back and talk about Happy Together, Wong Kar-wai. 1997. We'll be back right after this. Right. What a sweet romantic song that is. I mean, it is sweet ultimately, but it just, the way he's singing it. Oh, good stuff. Good old Frank Zappa. So there you go. All right. So we are talking Happy Together from 1997. I'll give a plot synopsis here. Let me find it. Here we go. A couple take a trip to Argentina. Both men find their lives drifting apart in opposite directions. Stars one, Leslie Cheung. How you say his name? Chihuahua Lung? I'd say Tony Lung. So,
Lung, yeah.
Yeah, let's just go with that. We're not going to go with his whole name here. Chang Chin's in here. Shirley Kwan. I think her scenes were cut, but
she wasn't.
And then Gregory Dayton is in here as a lover. So there's only five people listed as cast. So it's kind of interesting because there's more people than that in the film, actually. But this is a film about two folks, two gentlemen who are in love with each other. And it's a very passionate love affair, but also a very toxic one, I guess you could argue. Mm-hmm. To the point to where there are moments in the film where I was just like wanting them to get away from each other. It was so toxic. I don't know if you felt that on this rewatch or not, but.
Yeah, because it just feels like there's this inevitability of it ending poorly,
yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I feel like that speaks to all of us. At some juncture in our life, we've had relationships like this, right? Where
yeah.
they burn hot, but they
burn out.
They die pretty quick. And
I've had relationships in my youth that were purely physical, purely passion, maybe something I wanted more than the other person, maybe something they wanted more than me. So, you know, life is a very interesting thing. You never really know who you're going to end up with. If you're lucky, you end up with a pretty solid partner and you know, you have a pretty solid life and you decide to have kids, or you don't decide to have kids, either way, however you want to treat that. But it's almost like sometimes things happen for a reason. You almost got to believe, because, I mean, you got to believe that at some point in time you could have made the wrong decision, right? You could have dated somebody, and I'm sure I'm speaking to all of us, not just you, when I say this, mm-hmm. but we can probably all imagine that we could have ended up in a relationship that we were happy we didn't end up in.
Dodged a bullet.
Yeah, dodged a bullet, so to speak, or we can kind of laugh about it now. But, man, I've come close at least twice before I met my wife, and I think about that often. I think, wow, if I'd have just made a different decision, what could have happened? Now there's also that's the human condition, right? Because it could have been bad, but it could have also been great. Who knows? But that's humanity. And so what I like about this film is that Tony Leung and Leslie Cheung here, it feels like true passion throughout the movie. Like, they are, when they're angry with each other, they're almost petulant. They're kind of pouty. Yeah. And they're really kind of immature in a lot of ways. But it's this weird thing where they almost need each other to function in some way. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a interesting kind of look at looking at yourself. You know, you may have heard this terminology and stuff, that it's hard to love somebody if you don't love yourself, you know, or see people say things like that and stuff. And I agree with that. If you don't love yourself, you are going to have a hard time being empathetic and showing love toward other people, because if you're angry with yourself, you're going to be angry with everybody.
You're going to self-sabotage things because of issues in your own life.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you do feel at some point in this film that Tony Leung is headed toward that. He's drinking a lot. Both of them smoke a lot. There's a lot of smoking in this movie.
Hong Kong actors, the best of them, man.
Yeah. A lot of smoking. But you kind of feel at some point he's in. Now, Wong Kar-wai does something interesting here, which is he shoots some of the movie in black and white. He shoots some of it in kind of this saturated color look. Yes. Which I feel like he kind of used that same saturated color look in Chungking Express a little bit.
With Doyle being his DOP on most, if not all, of his work, they did work hand in hand, and a lot of the visual stuff does carry over, right? Mm-hmm. It's conveying something emotionally, aesthetically, and otherwise.
Yeah. So there's some interesting things going on here. I don't know what Wong Kar-wai is trying to say by doing some black and white and color mix. Eventually he goes full tilt color, and then he kind of comes back to black and white for a brief moment and then goes back to color. I don't know if it's a choice for narrative or if it's just Wong Kar-wai being Wong Kar-wai. I don't know if you get any interpretation of that.
So I felt, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear you great.
Good stuff. My dog's flipping a toy around and
I can barely hear that. So that tells me that we're on the right track.
Okay, good. Yeah, after many a moon, we seem to be on a good audio track. I feel like some of the stuff is a reflection of sort of nostalgia, reminiscing the black and white stuff. That could be just my subconscious as a film viewer too.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
We associate that with reflecting back on the past.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or the opposite's used, where they use color to almost look at things through rose-colored glasses, or commentary on that, because there's that line in the song. It's not the Staples Singers. Everybody's talking about the good old days that the Wu-Tang Clan samples.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's talking about the good old days. But time softens memory. Your memory softens things over time, right? So
right.
It's hard to say. I mean, I just think. There is certainly my dog with that toy. There's a certain lamentation about fate and decisions made. And I think he does try to accentuate that sometimes through stylistic choices.
Yeah. I think at first I was kind of, so this is a first time watch for me. Mm-hmm. Let me get that out there. I hadn't seen it. I'd always meant to. It's just one of those films in my, film lover lifestyle that I've just never gotten around to. So another great reason again, I will say over and over and over again for doing a podcast is because somebody will pick something that's probably on your quote unquote list of shame or however you want to call it that you've never gotten around to. This is one that I've just never, for whatever reason, have gotten around to and finally did now. So I was excited to sit down and watch it. I was a little taken aback by the black and white color mix at first because it was such an odd way he did it. And then I thought to myself, I didn't really have an interpretation of it. I like your interpretation of it. It works for me. But I didn't really have an interpretation of it. And then as time goes on, Wong Kar-wai is Wong Kar-wai. He's always going to be Wong Kar-wai.
He's an auteur.
So, yeah. So I have to accept that his love story in Buenos Aires is going to be this story. And it's going to be told like this. And the camera's going to be undercranked or overcranked. It's going to be saturated or it's going to be black and white. He is going to tell the story the way he wants to tell it. So once I accepted that, which was only about 10, 15 minutes into the movie flowed a lot better for me. But at first it was really kind of bothersome and kind of intrusive. So I just want to kind of get that out there in case anybody else feels that way. Because I think there's a lot of meat here, but you got to stick around for it.
It's a bit jarring if you... And you've seen a decent amount of his films. I think this is even our fourth film on the show.
Yeah, yeah. So, I've seen five, six, seven Wong Kar-wai films. At least that many. I know, maybe more.
But I get what you're saying, that people, like, he doesn't really make any concessions as a filmmaker. Like, he makes the film he wants to make, aesthetically and thematically and otherwise. And, and yeah, like you said, I think that's a good point to kind of settle in after that first 15 minutes or so, because it's, you know, you have to settle in.
Right. It's so jarring. Here's what I'll say is a good example. It's so jarring that me, a film lover, was like, is my TV messed up? Is this supposed to be in color? I had a moment where, yeah, have you ever like watched something and like for whatever reason the color fades out or something, or like maybe it's in digital format or something, maybe the file's not being read right, or maybe something's going on. And I watched this on the Criterion Channel, so I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, it's just not picking up the color, because it starts out in color, right? And it's just not picking up the color. And I found that to be a very harsh decision, not in a bad way, but just a very harsh decision stylistically. And I thought, there's no way Wong Kar-wai is doing this. Something's wrong with my TV. So I backed out of the Criterion app, went back in, and it was still black and white. And then I fast forward a little bit and it went to color. And then I rewound a little bit and it was to the beginning and it was in color. And I was like, okay, I see what you're doing. So that should tell you how jarring it is at first. And I want to make sure I kind of get that out there, because I think it's very important. I don't think it's a bad choice. Matter of fact, I think some people are going to fall in love with it immediately. But for me, it was quite the shocking moment of film change. It's almost like film degradation in a way. Almost like the black and white stuff is very, almost kind of granular and very interesting. Now, all that stuff I'm talking about doesn't take away from the story. What you have here is two lovers, essentially, two young men who have traveled down to Buenos Aires. They're having this very passionate affair. The movie opens with a sex scene. We know these guys love each other very much. And so we're kind of into it. And they talk about this lamp they buy, which is about these kind of magnificent waterfalls. I don't know where they're at. I guess they're in Argentina somewhere. I mean, it looks like a hole in the earth. This is craziest looking waterfall. One of the craziest looking waterfalls I've ever seen. Oh, yeah. And they had this lamp, and then they decide they're going to go on a road trip and discover this lamp. Now, I think this is very important. This road trip to see this mythical place in some ways is obviously almost like a hero's journey thing. And it becomes this kind of thing that they always wished to attain. And in that way, it kind of becomes a metaphor for their relationship. This waterfall, these rushing rapids, this hole in the earth, that should tell you a lot about the type of passion that is on display between Leslie Cheung and Tony Leung in this film. I think it's a great metaphor.
Absolutely.
I think it works very well for the story, and I think it pays off tremendously. You know, I want to pause to make sure, and we mentioned here, we talked about this, I think, when we did Chungking Express, or maybe even when we did Days of Running Wild. I think Leslie Cheung was in that, but I think we talked about the fact that he committed suicide, unfortunately, at like 45 or 46 years old.
Terrible loss.
Yeah, yeah. Great actor, a musician as well. I can't say I'm too into the music because, you know, it's another culture's music, but not that I have a problem with that. I just can't really sing along with it. But I know him from acting work, and he's always been amazing. He's always really good. A homosexual actor by nature. That is, I believe he claimed to be bisexual. I believe that's what he actually claimed. But he had some mental health problems. Depression was heavy and weighed on him heavily, and unfortunately, he would go on to throw himself out of a window. So it was terrible. It's a terrible tragedy, not just to his family, but to all of us who have seen him in these films, because he's left this kind of indelible mark on Asian cinema history, almost like, dare I say, I couldn't compare him to like a Jimmy Dean because he worked too much. I'm trying to think who I could compare him to, but he's one of those actors that you just wish you could have saw more of, you know?
He was a tremendous talent.
Yeah.
I know what you're saying. I knew you were going to say James Dean before you even said it, because I think there is a certain...
There's coolness here.
There's a certain coolness and I think a certain innate tragedy when you have the benefit of looking back retroactively at his performances and knowing what you know about his personal life.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, of course, there was always stories that Dean may have been bisexual. We don't know. There's just been stories and stuff. And then there's, again, I said last week, I'll say it again this week, there's no issues with Will and I about any of that stuff. But you got to think of the time. James Dean, when he's coming up, if in fact this is his proclivities and his way of life, he's going to hide that. Leslie Cheung, even in the 90s, as far as I know, Asian man culture is very manly, very macho in a lot of ways. The reason why there's a lot of great action cinema that comes out of Asia. I don't know if he would have to hide it as much, but I do know he's one of the first Asian stars to openly play a gay character and to openly admit to being homosexual. And obviously, you know, he faced some ridicule and criticism for that, unfortunately, but that is culture, and there has to be a harbinger. There has to be somebody to change the way of thinking. And I would say Leslie Cheung certainly was that, because I mean, he's worked with Wu, he's worked with Wong Kar-wai, and he's worked with great people and turned in great performances, and we're lucky we had him as long as we did, to be honest. And of course, Tony Leung, this guy is like, he's movie star up and down. I mean,
he's a goat, man.
Yeah.
He is absolutely, for my money, one of the greatest actors, regardless of.
Yeah. He can do anything.
Regardless of where he is in the world.
Yeah. He even did a Marvel movie, and he's amazing in that.
Which filled my heart with so much joy.
Yeah, I loved it too. I loved telling Landon that, you know, he's one of my favorite actors, and it's great to see him doing something like this so more people can be exposed to him, because he doesn't do a lot of American films. No. So that was great to see him in an American big budget film. That's sometimes the things I do love that Marvel does. In case anybody wonders, I'm not poo-pooing Marvel all the time. I am very happy that they managed to bring Tony Leung over, and there was another actor in there who played the old man in the village. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but you know who I'm talking about.
I just said Andy Lau, for fuck's sake. man, he always was a villain in the Shaw Brothers movies and in the Golden Harvest stuff.
Yeah, he was in Kung Fu Hustle. He played the one character. I can't remember what his power was, but Landon got a kick out of that when I told him that. He couldn't believe it was the same person. I'll look it up here in a minute. But anyway.
Yunhua.
Yeah, Yunhua. There you go. So we get to kind of go through the story with these characters and all this passion. And I think Wong Kar-wai does a really good job. First of all, this movie's not super long, so that helps, because this is a poisonous relationship. It's both a beautiful relationship and a poisonous relationship. And then he enters a third wheel into it. And I think you think it's going to go one way, and he kind of throws a curveball at you in some ways, and you find it doesn't go that way at all. It kind of just is a really sweet story about friendship and kind of longing and just caring for one another. It's a very human moment, you know, the restaurant work and the restaurant worker and all that stuff. And you know, that's a hard job. I'll be the first one to tell you that restaurant work is a hard job, but Chang Chen's in there, and he develops this relationship, and he has this kind of great moment. It's such a movie auteur moment too, of this record your thoughts on a Walkman so I can take them to this lighthouse and leave your sadness there. I mean, it all sounds so ridiculous, but cinematically it works, right? And I really like that. And I love their moment of a handshake and everything. And again, you think things are going to go a different way, but it's really just this story of not being alone. And I say that because at some point, Tony Leung's character says these words, and they're very haunting, but they're great. It's a great line that says, "Turns out lonely people are all the same."
Oh, man, great line. There's, you know, the thing that I always find about his work is, on the surface, it comes across sometimes as these simplistic observations, but almost childlike in their innocence, but there's such a profound emotional depth to them that there are these things that I think we never pause and give words to, that when he says it, it's like, man, he nails it.
Yeah. 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 And this one, I mean, he's had films that I've seen where I thought he goes full on, you know, Wong Kar-wai, like he's going to go full tilt, over stylized, things like that. Not in a bad way, but just, you know, a lot of style, a lot of things he does. Sometimes, sometimes his films are longer and they don't speak to me as much. But when he gets into the relationships, and I think this is what Chung King Express does as well. Sorry, that was a lot of wells. He really nails the relationship stuff. He's really, really good at that. And I was kind of looking at his filmography, and I can't believe he hasn't done anything for 9 years, going on 10 years now.
Was The Grandmaster his last film?
Yeah. Yeah, he hasn't done anything since then. I don't know if he can't get work or if he has retired or doesn't want to work.
I would assume some of that has to do with China's...
Where they're at, yeah.
Of Hong Kong film industry, which you don't see. And I could be wrong, but... There's really great mainland filmmakers, but a lot of the voices of Hong Kong film, like Johnny To and otherwise, and again, it could just be their arc as they're getting older. Both of those filmmakers are getting older.
Right.
But it just feels like there may be some reluctance to have their purity of artistic vision compromised by mainland censorship.
Right. And that's quite possible. I'm kind of surprised he hasn't come back over here and worked. You know, he tried to make a little bit of a beeline into the American film with My Blueberry Nights back in 2007.
That's right.
And it's a decent film. I mean, I don't think it shook any doors, but it seemed like he kind of went away and just made shorts after that. And then he made The Grandmaster, like what you talked about. Looks like he's attached to a couple television shows. Don't know if they're Netflix shows or whatever. One of them's called Blossom Shanghai. Another one's called Tong Wars. So I think, don't know what they are.
I think Tong Wars, ironically, is the name of a David Heavener joint. And I read about the other Blossom one, and it piqued my interest. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean...
So Tong Wars is going to be made by Amazon. So it looks like Amazon has probably... asked him if he wanted to do anything. So there you go. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your taste, I'm not going to knock you if you do this. This is where a lot of filmmakers are going now. This is what is happening, because I don't, and again, this could get me up on my soapbox again, but this is my problem with, you know, filmmakers like the Russo brothers and stuff like that. I mean, those guys are super successful. They made one of the biggest films in history. And again, they can't even touch a Wong Kar-wai film. So it's like, how is this? What has happened? But, you know, it is what it is. It is what it is. The way the story is told, the way it pays off, I think everything in this film really works. I really enjoyed it. I really did. But I will advise anybody that if you don't like toxic relationships, and when I say toxic, I mean screaming at each other, hitting each other, just flat out being mean to each other at times. You may not like this film that much. I think it's fair to say, but
it's one I hadn't considered.
Yeah.
I think you're right. Some people might have a sore spot for things like that where it might dredge up some things for them. Right.
Correct. And, correct.
How far you want to wade in those emotional waters, mileage is going to vary.
It's a pretty, it's raw performing from both these guys. These guys are screaming. They're smacking each other. They're, you know, these are primal screams too. Like they, I mean, these are screams of true pain. There's moments when Leslie Cheung will lay on a bed and cry, and I just almost want to cry with him.
Yeah.
And it's like true, like relationship pain.
Yeah. Like, it feels authentic. It feels earned. It doesn't feel
yeah.
and over the top just for the sake of it.
It's like, I don't know if any, you know, if anybody can relate to this, so I'm going to tell the story, but you know, I've said things or done things in relationships where I said the mean thing to make somebody cry. And then I go in the other room and I'm crying because I can't believe I was so mean.
Oh man. That's the worst feeling.
It is.
You can't put that genie back in the bottle. It is the absolute worst feeling.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, what did I just do?
Yeah. It's self-destructive is what it is. And it's a dangerous place to go. But unfortunately a lot of us, I think as human beings, we either have gone there or maybe some of us still do. I'm not going to judge people. Everybody's different, but it's just really hard to watch that kind of destruction and that kind of emotional, I wouldn't call it rape, but it's more like, I don't know, man. It's like a claw across the back or something. Like it's like somebody digs their fingernails into your emotions and just rips them to shreds.
Yeah.
And I think Wong Kar-wai does a really, really good job of portraying that here. Like it feels very immediate. It feels very, if this doesn't work out, it's the last person I will ever be in love with. It feels like that. And if you think about the waterfall in terms of the relationship and the tears and everything else, it's really very good auteur filmmaking. Really very good. I have to say this is probably one of my favorite Wong Kar-wai films now. So I'm really happy you introduced it to me because before, I mean, I really have always liked Chungking Express. Days of Being Wild we did, which I enjoyed as well. But this one's going to stick with me for a while because this one, I felt like the raw emotion was what I wanted. And I got that. And I kind of saw it coming. I kind of saw this is going to be that kind of story. And it's going to fall on these two actors to make me care about either one of them. And they did a damn fine job making me care about them. And they made me angry. They made me happy. They made me scared. They made me all those things. And that's what great acting and directing can do. So it's a very simple film, too. It's amazing how much he gets out of one small apartment, one small kitchen.
96 minutes, two actors, essentially.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's very well done filmmaking. This is what I personally enjoy in filmmaking. Don't get me wrong. I love watching people get kicked in the face. I love watching people jump off of buildings. I love all that stuff, too. But when it comes down to it, sometimes I just want to watch people work off each other and riff. And this is, I mean, you're talking about two giants of Asian cinema, in my opinion, riffing on each other and in this relationship. And it's one of the best portrayals of a broken relationship I think I've ever seen.
Tragic relationship.
Yeah, too. Yeah. But I'll kick it over to you. Hear your thoughts on the rewatch.
Cool. All right. So I've been very forthright throughout the years of doing our show that Wong Kar-wai is like a top 10, maybe top 5 filmmaker all time for me. Some filmmakers linger on things thematically and otherwise that resonate. I'm a very sentimental person. A lot of my favorite filmmakers are very sentimental. Pedro Almodovar, Terrence Malick, Jodorowsky.
Yeah.
Why? Sorrentino. I mean, most, if not all, my favorite filmmakers have a very sentimental, reflective quality.
A lot of those guys are very, they have a lot of things in common. They're very different, but a lot of those guys have a lot of things in common.
How have I not picked this for the show? But again, it's one of those things, just the circuitous roads we take. I just felt like I really wanted to get a Hong Kong film on. I thought, well, I didn't want to just go with as much as I love Parrot or something like that. I want to do something that, we could just really, really chew on here. And I'm glad that we could, because I feel like this one, you get two of the finest actors of a generation with Cheung and Leung. And like you said, the beauty is in the simplicity of this, because Wong Kar-wai, despite thrusting them into a cramped apartment, he gives them room to breathe dramatically. And so much of this film emotionally resonates. When you said you were talking to everyone earlier, I think there's so many things that will speak to so many people relationship-wise.
Yeah.
Relationships they've been in. And Doyle's work, as always, again, hand in glove, right? I just think he's one of the best DOPs of his time. And his work with Wong Kar-wai is always just, it complements it so well. You know, I was watching this film thinking about Pedro Almodovar. And I don't know if subconsciously it's because the setting was Argentina, you know, proximity wise, obviously closer to Spain than Hong Kong is. But I'm thinking about him. And then I almost fell out of my chair because I'd forgotten about it at the time. But there's the song, you know, the song that's in this, it's Kukurukuru Paloma.
Yeah.
So that song is used so beautifully in Talk to Her, the Almodovar film. And it just, I found it to be such a delicious irony that these two filmmakers who resonate with me so much, I'm thinking of one while I'm watching a film from the other one, and then boom, this song comes in and it's used pretty beautifully. So I thought that was interesting. And then, you know, the monochrome stuff like you talked about, I think the film looks degraded, which again, I think is a conscious decision to make us, sometimes our memories are a little bit distorted and faded, right?
Yeah. Yeah, monochrome might be a better description of it than black and white.
Yeah, it's got this beat up kind of monochromatic feeling. And it's even like a lot of the fishbowl stuff that that Wong Kar-wai and Doyle like using, that almost feels Gilliam-esque at times. Like, it doesn't have the same energy or it doesn't hang on it as much, but it's funny. And then there's even some of the monochromatic stuff really feels almost like Italian neorealist with the setting, right? With Argentina and the old 40s club. It feels almost like an old bogey film or something.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. And then we get Leslie Cheung. Like, was he wearing a mohair cardigan intermittently in this film?
He may have been.
The emotional authenticity in this film is, again, what really resonates. So this feels like a couple that's fed up with each other's shit. And then we get that beautiful line that's uttered throughout the film, let's start over. And I think that's, when you have doomed lovers, I feel like that's like the doomed lovers mantra.
Right.
You know, they were brought together in a moment of passion. It doesn't have to just be physically. There can be this passionate connection emotionally, actually.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when things burn that hot, and then they just completely flame out, like you'd said, that let's start over. It's almost like we need to chase this dream, chase this ghost, the emotional ghost here.
Right.
Right. And I love that, that the simplicity of that, but how profound it is. I love Wong Kar-wai's observation on the burden of responsibility on a lover as far as the relationship, the roles that we play in relationships. Tony Leung's character is, by and large, more responsible, more pragmatic. He's the more mature one of the two.
Right.
And he's left to do a lot of the lifting, and there's that burden of responsibility, because we've all had relationships where there's been a disparity in responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? The cooking, the tending for him when he's sick, all that stuff, right? Those acts of love.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting because they could make the Tony Leung character, because he's, to me, and maybe it's just my love of Tony Leung, but he's the cooler character of the two, but he's also the more empathetic of the two, right? He's the caring one. I think Leslie Cheung cares, but he doesn't know how to show that.
I agree. I think he loves him deeply and intensely, but I just feel like he doesn't know how to share it in the same way, and that comes into this whole thing of languages of love and how people show their love, right? It's a very interesting thing. The film just, you know, the immediacy and intimacy of the way it's shot, the way it's written, and the way these actors perform it is really wonderful. What else is wonderful is Tony's egg cracking technique, man. One hand on point.
It's very good. It's very solid. I was very envious of that.
I gotta say, I am a very mediocre egg cracker. I always crack tentatively where I don't want to just shatter the egg, and then I end up inevitably getting eggshells in my shit and having to scoop it out.
Yeah. It is an art. It is an art to be that precise.
You gotta crack with confidence.
Yeah. Well, you know, the I mean, it's just impressive. The crack, the one hand tap. I think he taps twice, cracks, he opens it up with one hand. That's impressive. That's impressive.
A man of many talents.
Yes. And I can't remember if he's smoking while he's cooking or not either, but if he is and he's not getting ashes in there, he's even more talented than we think.
They're very good. I love the moment when they're dancing. I think it's lit beautifully. I think there's a very specific intent to light it like they're the only people in the world. I love that quiet moment. I think it's beautifully kind of poignant. Mm-hmm. I think it communicates a lot in terms of how they're feeling as characters in that moment, right? We all long for those quiet moments of emotional connection, and that feels like that for them, and that's what they're chasing through the fights and when the hangover wears off from that, right?
Right.
I love the color composition. I think that Wong Kar-wai has always done it. He's had a very, very strong command, again, working with Doyle. This feels, all of his films, like they, if something's hot, it feels steamy and hot and green, and the yellows and the reds feel very warm and muggy, and it just, he always conveys that very well with his films. I love the line, if I can't, this speaks to anyone who's had a partner who's has more energy than them. If I can't sleep, you won't sleep either. You know that.
Yes. It's that petulant behavior I would like to say I've never been guilty of something so silly, but I would be lying to all of our listeners. I'm sure I know I've done things just as ridiculous as that. I know I've been the baby.
My wife and I have, we listen, there's times where she tends to be the one that wants to bug me and poke me and prod me. And I'm like, I just want to just stop and say, you know, you love it. And it's funny because I do, like, as much as I feign kind of annoyance, the room would be too quiet to not have that, right? It's that yin and yang that when you can get those moments of harmony, right? So
my wife, who, if she ever listens to this, well, she will completely agree with the fact she likes to tell me all the time how annoying I am. But when I'm not around, she calls me. So
you know what I say to my wife, my retort is always, I am not annoying. You allow yourself to easily be annoyed.
Yeah, there you go.
Actively annoy me.
But if I don't annoy, I get asked what's wrong with me.
That's right.
So it's like, okay, well, nothing. I just don't feel like being annoying right now.
Time for the foot rest, baby.
Yeah, so it's just, you know, marriage is, we've talked about it before, it's work, but it is not only just work, it's hard. Anybody that tells you otherwise is a lying motherfucker. That's what I'll say.
That's facts.
And I am 100% positive that if you tell me marriage is easy, you are lying to my face.
A lot.
You go be married for 20 years and you tell me how it's what it's like. Let me tell you, buddy, it ain't the same.
No, it's a lot of heavy lifting, a lot of selflessness, a lot of concessions. It's work, man.
Yeah, it is. It's great, but it's tough.
It is tough, though, absolutely. They do a good job dealing with the nagging things in relationships, more of a younger relationship, or I guess even any relationship, the nagging things that go unsaid or misunderstood.
Yeah. It's a mercurial relationship. You know, we use that word sometimes. That's what it's like to me. It's a supernova.
Yep. It is. And they use the TV to drown out the silence at times because the noise, you know, that energizes them. Mm-hmm. I love the sort of observation, and I've often said this in life, people love the best way they know how, and sometimes it doesn't converge or mesh in time how we hope it does. Our past scars, our past insecurities take hold, and they kind of poison the water, and I think that's very evident in this relationship.
Yes, I agree.
What else? There's a really great scene with the supporting actor in this. He talks about growing up without having use of his eyes very much and how it's his ears, and he learned to trust his ears. And just really, really good scene. Again, these small little scenes that he does so well, right? It's good. It's good stuff, man. Very good stuff. We even get that little chunking shift of focus for a bit, right? Where it almost feels like people passing in and out of our lives, right?
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, that happens. People, yeah. Friends, lovers, people come and go in our lives, and things kind of shift.
I can see folks maybe being a bit deterred by the third character they introduced, but I think it's important, that third character, because I think it's a reflective moment. It's a moment for Lung to kind of look back and realize that there, you know, even through all the pain, there was some good stuff there.
Yes, yes. And I, you know, the thing I really love about that is, and you can interpret this a number of ways, but the way I saw that was, and it's sort of evidenced by Tony Leung's line, you look a lot like someone who's blind. And we've all had these doppelgangers in our lives that we've had in our lives to fill emotional voids to a degree. And the character feels a little bit like a facsimile. I don't even think it's a conscious decision by Leung. It doesn't feel like a ruthless decision. I think he finds comfort in the friendship, and there's a sincerity and a warmth there. But I think it was a fantastic observation on pinning our hopes on a facsimile sometimes, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah.
Very interesting. And then last note is I love, love, love how he always uses alleyways and corridors as something that's symbolic and metaphorical to the alleyways, the blind alleyways and the corridors we go down in life and where they take us. So,
yeah. Yeah. He does do that. He shoots cramped spaces very well. I'll give him that. I mean, like I said, in this film, I already talked about that, but I mean, I think about his film. I mean, he can open up and do vistas and everything as well, but man, he really knows how to handle small lofts or flats or apartments, however you want to call them. And, you know, alleyways and things like that. He really gets the most out of that stuff. So, okay. Make or break for me. It's not really a cheat because I think it's very important, but it is at the end of the film, and it's once Tony Leung reaches his destination. And I found that enlightening and heartbreaking, and I think it's well worth sticking around for. There's a lot of great moments in between, though. Really, there is. I mean, there's a lot of great moments in between. But that moment really is one heck of a payoff. And I really enjoyed it a lot. MVT. So I probably picked Wong Kar-wai before. But I want to go with him, but I'm going to go with Tony Leung here because I really identify with his character somehow. I don't know how, but I like to think of myself as an empathetic person, a person who tries to help. I don't talk about it much, but I'm always the kind of person who, you know, tries to make sure everybody else is okay before I make sure I'm okay. And I feel like that's Tony Leung's character here. Even as dark as he gets, where he's drinking booze on the sidewalk and throwing a watch on the ground, he still cares. So, you know, he's complicated. But I think ultimately his empathy wins out most of the time. So he's not above being a jerk, don't get me wrong. But he's also, you know, he's a human being. So I love that he's still caring in that way, that it's kind of unexplainable. Very human trait, though. My score for the film, 8.5 out of 10, man. I love this thing. This is a great movie. This is well worth your time. If you haven't seen it, it's on the Criterion Collection channel, if you have that. If not, I think Criterion put out a Wong Kar-wai box set not too long ago, which I think was like $200. But it had just about everything in there. So if you were a fan, if it's still around, I'd definitely wait for that sale. You could probably get it for $100, and that'd be well worth it.
Why am I?
Get that 50% off, baby. But yeah, that's all I got.
Nice. Okay. Make or break, man. I'm still torn. I just don't know where to go with this. I don't feel like there's one crowning moment because there's so many great, profound, quiet moments and things that kind of reveal themselves subtly, even though Wong Kar-wai is a splashy visual filmmaker. I guess I'm going to go with that dancing moment. I just feel like that's the magic they're chasing every time Leslie Cheung says, "Let's start over," is that moment. And the nature of the emotional perfection that they're trying to attain, right? It's something we all chase, those moments that we can hang on to when we're on our deathbed and we look back at the moments with our lovers that meant the most. And that's what they're chasing, right?
It's
they're chasing that moment. So I think to me, it's such a profound moment. It's encapsulated perfectly. MVT, I could have gone with Wong Kar-wai. I feel like we've given it to him before. I'm going to do a little more have my cake and eat it too in a way. I'm going to go with Leung and Chung. Mm. I feel like you have to have the give and take of both of them. And as much as, of course, I can relate more to Leung's character, I feel like you need both to really appreciate this. And I just want to shout out Leslie Chung, because I just feel like I don't know that there's two better actors in Hong Kong. And I know that's a bold statement. I know I'm overlooking a lot of incredible actors, but I just feel like those two are as good as it gets. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And my score is the exact same as yours, an 8.5 out of 10. I think it's a tremendous film. I haven't seen this film. I hadn't seen it in probably 20 years. I'm glad I revisited it. I'm glad you finally got to see it, and I'm glad we could talk about it.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
To be onto this, hey, you got a question. Go watch this film.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Check it out. You will not be disappointed. All right. That's everything. I don't really know what we're doing next week, because I might be trying to set something up. So we'll just leave you hanging this week. We'll see. We think we might know. I don't know. I'll find out. If not, trust me, you'll get a show next week. Don't worry. I don't really have a whole lot more to add. I want to say thank you to the Not a Bomb guys. I did a TV podcast with them, kind of a limited series type thing for Cowboy Bebop, the anime. And it was a fun adventure. It was like 12, 13 episodes. Got to work with our podcast with Zoe from the Backlook podcast, Backlook Cinema podcast, on the last episode. And it was great meeting him, and it was great talking and going on that journey with those guys for the television show. I tell you, and I told them this, it's reviewing television is so much more difficult for me than films, because films speak to me on a more emotional level. Television's more of a story-based platform for me, and I like that. I like that story. I like that, but I don't really get caught up in the emotions of it as much as I do with films. But it was an interesting experiment, and one that I wouldn't mind doing again sometime in the future. But, man, I was nervous, let me tell you. But those are all over on there, and you can check out their show. I'm on there occasionally. Their show is great anyway, but you can definitely check that out. I just want to make sure I plug that, because I don't plug people very much, and I'm terrible about that, and I apologize. But definitely check it out if you like listening to me. But check out those guys, too, because I think you'll like their show. I think you will. They're fighting for the underdog a lot over there.
All the show. I got to say, they do a good show, man.
Yeah, they do. I think it's all I got. Again, we'll be back next week. Don't know with what, but I'll let you know. Until then, I'll say adios.
Adios.
Thanks for listening. You can find the gentleman at ggtmc.com, and you can email the gentleman at midnightcinema@gmail.com.